The sump pump thumping away had disguised the sound of Skip pounding at the back door. He stepped inside, water rolling off his borrowed jacket and onto the checkerboard linoleum. "Outside!" Nadine yelled. "Outside!" "Nonsense. Come in, Charles. Hang those things up and sit down." Nadine muttered, pulling the string mop from the broom closet. "That's right, Nadine. A little water never hurt anyone. Except your pants, Charles, which are soaked to the ankle, even with the waders." "It's bad out there," he said. "My father installed that sluiceway when I was a child. He said it was foolproof. It's all choked up." Bailing with a bucket hardly seems the best way to deal with the problem. The bucket was for the fish. The fish and the frogs. The pond so far outside its banks that the lawn was all covered with trout and bass flopping around. And about 100 frogs. Snakes, too, but I'm not rescuing snakes. I just got everybody back in the pond with the bucket. There's a few still out there that don't look like they're going to make it. "Nadine, do you want 2 or 3 trout for dinner?"
"No clean fish,"
Jennifer laughed. "Miss Marty," Nadine said. "That's a good idea, Nadine. Jennifer and Charles will have lunch with me. Charles can bring in some fish, and you can sauté them. There are grapes in the icebox and potato salad. Then you can take the rest of the day off."
"Ay, ay, ay."
"I'm sorry, Mrs. Blessing," Jennifer said, standing and putting her cup in the sink. "My mother's right. I have to get to class. I really wanted to stay longer, but in this weather it's going to take me a while to get where I'm going." She looked at Skip. "I wanted to tell you that I saw your friend at the hospital the other day. He messed himself up pretty bad."
"Yeah?"
"I work in physical therapy part-time every once in a while. He's going to have some job learning to walk again without a limp. And the scars, right?"
"And the scars. Although he's the kind of guy who seems like he'd like to have a scar or two."
This time it was she who colored.
"Sorry, that sounded cruel."
"You're right." "Not about how it sounded. You're right that he'll probably like having them. Tough guy, and all that." Skip ran his hands through his hair, and a drizzle scattered around him. "I gotta go, too. I got stuff over in the garage, you know, things to do over there." When they were both gone, Mrs. Blessing settled herself at the table on the long porch and turned on the monitor. Bath time, she thought, listening to the faint splashing sound of the water from the old faucet and the tuneless singing that rose above it. A vista of bent and flattened flowers in fuzzy daubs was faintly visible through the shears at the windows. When she had first moved to Blessing's, she had taken down the curtains, all of them, to let in the light and the sight of the outdoors. "Is this some modern invention?" her mother had said. And then slowly, over the years, she had ordered others and had them hung, until once again the house was veiled. Jennifer was in some classroom smelling of chalk, its linoleum scuffed and torn, and Charles was in the bare garage apartment, which she'd been half ashamed to see when she'd gone to demand his help that night. And here she sat in solitary splendor with a tuna fish sandwich and 2 olives, as she had done for years and years, happily or at least contentedly. All broken now. The happiness or contentment or resignation or whatever it was a person felt when the repeated customs of her life had become that life itself. For all around her was a shadow lunch, an imagined lunch. The one in which the aroma of butter and fresh fish filled the air, clinging slightly for a day or two to the brocade drapes, in which she listened to the 2 young people speak of people she did not know. Things she cared nothing for, the smell of carbolic soap from the man, the smell of some lemon shampoo from the girl, the air of unimportant everyday sociability about the meal, and the child at its center, crowing and smiling and waving her arms about. They had all made her want more than she had. The curse of having young people about the house was that they were always so redolent of possibility. She turned off the little machine that brought her the sounds of life from across the way. Nadine came in to clear the plate, muttering to herself, and wiped the table with a series of grunts and groans, and Lydia Blessing sat without moving as the gray light of the rainy day grew even grayer with dusk. She had had a pain behind one eye for the last few days,
and a pain in one arm, and she rubbed the arm and pressed her fingers to the spot above her brow. And instead of just this one lunch that seemed to have taken on an importance out of all proportion to its reality, she conjured up an entire life that might have been. Once again, she imagined the apartment in the building on Park Avenue, the antique oriental blue and white plates on stands on the sideboard, the floral prints on the drapes, the doorman who would hail a cab when she went to the club or to meet Meredith at the symphony, the gin and tonics on a silver tray as the sun set behind the building across the way. And suddenly she knew in her bones, the way she knew the alphabet or the Lord's Prayer or the piano fingering to Clair de Lune, that that was a life no better than the life she had had. The great grievance she had felt for so long, the sense of being done out of something by her mother, by her daughter, by her class, by chance, by fate. It was a Potemkin village, a stage set, a papier-mâché thing that had lost its power. She had filled her days mourning that shadow life, and it had no more meaning than the chattering of monkeys. Instead, these last few weeks, she had seen what might have been had she not felt perpetually done out of something better. From the window, Blessings was almost invisible in the heavy rain. But she knew that even in this terrible chill downpour, it was no longer the claustrophobic prison she had styled it for so long. It was what it had always been, a refuge. And for some reason, she remembered an argument she had had with Jesse one summer, when she'd been preparing to send Meredith to boarding school. "This is the right thing for a girl in her situation," she had said as she looked over a box of white uniform blouses. "For God's sake, Lydia," Jess had said, her eyes dark. "Can't you for once in your life stop thinking about what's right and start considering what's good?" She jerked upright in the chair, her hand still pressed to her head, thinking perhaps she had fallen asleep. The rain had stopped, and in the way of summer storms, had left an evening of delicately scented and colored beauty behind it. The beaten-down stems of the daisies and the cone flowers seemed to rise slowly back toward the sky, to be prepared to be warmed by the sun that had been drowned for so many days. The pounding of the sump pump had stopped, and the air was filled only with the clicking of bent-legged insects, cicadas and crickets. Across the room was the telephone, an old rotary dial phone she had never thought to replace, and with her hands shaking, she dialed and waited. "Meredith," she said when she heard her daughter's voice. "Meredith." And in her voice was something of such unnatural, unknowable shape and form that she had no idea what she would say, feared that she might be like the girl in one of her childhood fairy tales who opens her mouth and spits out a frog. "Mother," Meredith replied, "are you all right? Mother, is everything all right?" "We've had terrible rain. The pond overflowed and the boat floated out." "How was your trip home? How is it in Virginia? How are your hollyhocks?" "My hollyhocks? Did the rain hurt them?" "It's beautiful here, Mother. We haven't had any rain. My flowers are fine." "Those pink hollyhocks I got from that catalog you sent me were a beautiful color. That true rich pink, not too pale and not too purpley. Is that what you're talking about? Are you certain you're all right?" There was a silence, and then she said, "Meredith, send me seeds. When the season is over, when everything has died back, send me seeds." What was it she had really meant to say? It was in her mind, her heart, everywhere in her, the notion that she must say something to lift the weight of those years of resenting her self-imposed exile. That was what it had been, after all. She could have gone at any time, but she had not. Once, she remembered, she had spent a week in Paris and could not wait to come home. The Mona Lisa had been so much smaller than she'd expected. "Come see me," was all she said to Meredith. "Come see me soon." The lights came on around the house, and she got out of the chair slowly, her back a little stiff. Nadine had left half a chicken on a plate in the oven, some sliced tomatoes and potato salad under plastic wrap on the counter. She pushed it all down the disposal with her fork. It was waste, but it was her waist. She walked slowly to the window that looked west. The lavender, gray, and pink striations of the sunset were mirrored in the crackle glass surface of the pond. The fields of ryegrass turned golden by the heat and shiny by the rain. As she watched, a string of lights appeared around the edge of the water. Her father had had them sunk into the banks of the pond, one every few feet, and the first time he threw the switch, he had beamed like a boy, although his skin was already loose around the neck, gray and loose. Meredith had been a child then. Lids, my love, had given way to Mary, darling. Lydia had watched the lights come on from an Adirondack chair, her long plaid skirts eddying around her ankles. "It looks like a carnival ride," she'd said. "Exactly," Lydia's father had said. "It's brilliant, isn't it, Mary, darling? We love it, don't we?" He had taken the little girl out in the boat, and the two of them had rowed from light to light. Or he had rowed, and pretended she was doing so too, as she dragged the little oar he had made for her through the water. At each light, he told her to make a wish. A pony, a pink bicycle, a spaniel puppy. "That's too many wishes," Lydia had called across the darkening oval at the center of the ring of lights, and her father had called back, "Ah, Lids, my love, don't ever say that." One by one over the years, the lights had burned themselves out. Her father had died the year after he'd illuminated the pond. Her mother had slept her last years away in the expensive nursing home, in a valley thick with wild rhododendrons 10 miles from Mount Mason. "I know you," she said when Lydia drove over to see her. "I know who you are." The night before she died, she had told the nurses she needed to leave. "I don't belong here," she'd said. Those were her last words, they told Lydia. The old cherry bedroom suite that had been shipped from the city apartment to the nursing home was in one of the back bedrooms now. In the narrow top drawer of the bureau, she had found faded pictures of a young man she didn't recognize, a yellow baby sweater with buttons shaped like ducks, and a slim book of poetry by Sarah Teasdale. "To Ethie, forever yours, Eddie," it said inside in faded ink in her father's beautiful handwriting. When Sunny died, over the rise and down the hill and in the barn, she could not even bear to go through his things. The Fosters had packed up what was in his room at Blessings, and she had allowed his landlord to turn over the contents of his apartment to the Salvation Army. Jess had left her a starburst brooch and her leather-bound collection of Edith Wharton, and a needlepoint bench with a floral design that she used at the piano. All around her were the possessions of the dead. The boat had floated from the center of the pond and lay at the foot of one of the willow trees, wedged into its roots so that it would be easy to get ashore in the morning. How had it happened that only it and she remained in this place? How had it happened that Blessings was slowly being resurrected and she with it? Charles had restored the lights around the pond without asking. And when she had first seen them lit, she had felt a love for her father that she thought had been long burned out. She cried once, briefly, two sobs that wrenched her thin chest. Then she went upstairs and slept deeply, without dreams. Lydia Blessing had not seen Paul Benjamin for several years, since he had visited her in the hospital when she had had her stroke, and she was surprised at how old he looked. His chest was concave so that his old reptile, frayed at the edges, made a fish hook from chin to belt. She had always found him a useful doctor, a believer in the old remedies that she had never abandoned: camphor on the chest, tea with lemon and honey, salts and enemas, hot whiskey when absolutely necessary. At one time they had known each other well, and when at age 40 he had married a younger woman, a nurse he met at the hospital, Lydia had from time to time invited them as dinner guests when she had people come for the weekends. One May evening, she remembered, he had had too much to drink and recited "Casey at the Bat" on the end of the diving board, then fallen into the pond. He had come up spouting water like a whale, and everyone had cheered except for his young wife, who turned red and pushed him into the car to go home, dripping wet. She had overdressed for the party and been out of sorts all night because of it.
Hello, Lydia,
he said as he edged himself slowly out of his car, the same sort of car she had, a Cadillac that looked as though it had been frozen in amber since the day some years ago when it had been manufactured.
You seem in fine fettle. I'm 80, Paul, which I believe makes you 90?
91, last month.
I have gout. It's a ridiculous thing. Henry VIII had it. No wonder he killed his wives. My father had a classmate from Princeton who had it. I was told it was because he drank so much.
That's an old wives' tale,
Paul Benjamin said, reaching for the old black bag he'd once told her his parents gave him when he graduated from medical school.
That's what all these doctors say about everything. Anything you like is bad for you. It's a miracle we've lived this long, according to their lights. Although this young man who took over for me isn't bad. You should have had him for this. Lydia, I haven't looked at a baby in Lord knows how long.
Faith was in the living room, lying on a receiving blanket on the brocade couch. Jennifer Foster bent over her, while Skip sat in the wing chair in the dark corner shadowed by the awning and the porch overhang. Paul Benjamin peered down at the moon face with its fuzz of blonde hair. The baby was doing what Skip loved to watch her do, coming alive bit by bit, taking in the world by inches, curling her toes around the air, moving her fingers against one another in the side of her own face, staring at the light and moving her tongue thoughtfully between her lips, tasting the air. She blew pensively through her lips. A bubble formed, then broke, and she sneezed suddenly and went still.
"Is this your baby, young lady?"
the doctor said, narrowing his eyes.
"Of course it isn't her baby, Paul. Look at her, that's the foster girl. This child is the grandchild of an old friend of mine who's visiting from the vineyard. The baby is staying with her for several weeks while her daughter and son-in-law are in Europe, and they realized she needed her shots."
Mrs. Blessing was surprised at how fluently she lied. Much better than she'd done it years before, when it had been so much more important, at least to her. She realized that lying was easier than telling the truth because it had such nice smooth edges, not jagged with impossibility and inconvenience the way the truth so often was. If she were to tell Paul Benjamin the truth about Faith, he would say,
"What?"
with a deep and solemn air of disbelief. The lie went down like honey.
"She looks healthy enough. It is a she, isn't it? Pretty little girl. But her mother will need to mind the son. She's as fair as a Swede. Take her clothes off, young lady."
All the old familiar instruments came out of the black bag. All the things that had seemed so sinister when she was a child. The pointed things for the eyes and nose. The cold and glittery stethoscope. The doctor from whom Paul Benjamin had bought his practice had let Lydia listen to her own heart once when she was 8 or 9, and she was amazed at how inexorable it sounded, like the engine of some considerable machine. Without realizing it, she put her hand over her heart, still there working all these years later. That other doctor had been named Brown, she remembered, and her father had delighted in kidding him about a patent medicine for indigestion called Dr. Brown's. Ed Blessing had loved that about Mount Mason. The simple country doctor, the simple country lawyer. It made no difference to him that Dr. Brown had been at Exeter and Yale. Simple country was what he wanted, and it was what he was certain he had gotten.
"A very healthy child," said Paul Benjamin, folding his stethoscope. "I can't imagine what you thought was the matter."
"Nothing's the matter. She needed to be looked at. And the shots, too, the ones for measles and all the rest. I can't recall exactly the shots they all get now.
German measles, too. They used to have to send the children away when mother was expecting because the German measles were terrible for the baby in womb. Horrible things we saw. Deaf, blind, retarded babies that went right to the state hospital." He nodded. "All over now, of course. I'll need the grandmother's signature on something.
The state makes a martyr of us medical people now with all the forms and so forth.
I'll send it on, said Mrs. Blessing. She's visiting friends in the city right now. I'll be happy to sign in her stead. I have some questions she wanted answered.
Mrs. Blessing put on her glasses and took a piece of paper from the top of the piano.
When should she begin solid food?
4 months or so.
Will the granny be keeping her that long?
I'm not sure. What sort of food to begin?
Some kind of cereal mixed with formula. Not rice. That will constipate her.
How are her stools?
Oh, for pity's sake, they're fine. How should they be?
Should she be sitting up yet?
Dr. Benjamin put out his hands and Faith curled her fingers around his. He tugged gently and she rose into a sitting position.
Voila,
he said.
Ah, said Mrs. Blessing.
She used a finger to find the next question on the list Skip had prepared.
Vitamins?
Not yet. Her mother can ask for them at about a year.
All right.
Mrs. Blessing looked down the list and rolled her eyes. Overall, how does she look to you?
Grand. A very nice baby, healthy and well cared for.
Now, may I inoculate her so she'll stay that way?
Should I leave her clothes off? Said Jennifer softly.
I just need a leg free. But I'm not sure this is right, Lydia. I could pop over when her granny's here. I need to fill in this form with the name and so forth, date of birth, all the vitals.
I'll send it on to you.
Paul Benjamin sighed heavily, his bowed chest rising and falling. His hands were a mess of liver spots, and they shook slightly as he filled the syringe. Lydia knew they were thinking of the same thing, the night she called him after she had found Sonny in the barn.
I cannot give a certificate that says natural causes, Lydia. I cannot, and I will not, he had said.
Accident, then. Accidental death. He had sighed then, too, she remembered, and his hands were shaking, but shaking then because of the sight of Sonny, his luminous golden hair atop the hole where his face had been, the shotgun shining atop his chest. Paul Benjamin pinched a roll of mottled baby fat between his thumb and forefinger and plunged the needle in. Faith had been staring vacantly at the ceiling, and for just a moment her eyes were puzzled and her brow knit. Then her face went red and she screamed, gasped, and lost her breath, screamed again. Without a word, Skip left his chair, lifted her off the couch half-naked, and carried her away.
Now, who was that boy, Lydia? Does he know what he's doing? Young lady, give that baby a bottle now and tell her grandmother that she may have a fever in a day or two. You take care of her until her granny's back. She'll be fine. This lady here is too far along in years to be saddled with an infant.
I beg your pardon, Lydia said.
That is not to denigrate her. She's the finest specimen you'd want to see. When's the last time you swam the pond, Lydia?
Not in years.
Is that pond still full of snapping turtles?
It was then.
What do you think she said when I would remind her of that?
I can't imagine, Jennifer Foster said, smiling.
She said, no snapping turtle would come near me. And she was right. Of course, there was that one man from someplace. Boston, was it, when we were younger?
That was entirely his own fault, Mrs. Blessing said. A mucky bottom pond is not designed for standing up.
My predecessor took care of him, Dr. Benjamin said, packing up his bag. Not much he could do back then. Maybe today they'd put the toe on ice, send him along to the big medical center in Bessemer. Back then, there was nothing.
A snapper bit off his toe? Said Jennifer.
It was completely his own fault, Mrs. Blessing said. Now here's something that was Lydia's fault. One day she comes home from the club, and she's in a temper because she'd lost in a doubles round.
Oh, for pity's sake, Paul, this old story.
You don't like hearing that one, do you?
Who were you playing with? Jessie?
I always played doubles with Jess, and she always played deplorably and laughed about it.
That was a girl, Jessie. In any event, Lydia here comes home in a temper, hops out of the car, strips down, and jumps in the pond. And what do you think is waiting for her in the water by the dock when she swims back? Oh, for pity's sake. Her Cadillac, in 4 feet of water. She'd been in such a temper she left the engine running and didn't engage the parking brake. Oh, that was a pretty feat of engineering Foster had getting that car to run again. And the upholstery smelled like fish for a year. Nonsense, Mrs. Blessing said. Put that baby down for a nap after her bottle, the doctor added. She'll sleep a while after this. I didn't truly hurt her. She was just aggravated at the pinch. But she may have a fever in a day or two. He looked at Jennifer. You tell that young man. She may have a slight fever and some crankiness. It's perfectly normal. Mrs. Blessing walked him out to his car, taking his arm as the two of them came down the steps. Who's holding up who? He said. Or whom? Thank you, Paul. I'll send that paper by return mail when it arrives. I'd prefer it if you didn't mention this visit to anyone. He shrugged and sighed, and she wondered whether he believed what she had told him after all. You've always been a terror, it's true, he said. And I'm too old now to lose my license, whatever you're up to. They stood together at the car, and he looked out over the pond to the line of cedar trees along the creek, and his big sad eyes, which had always reminded her of the eyes of one of the hunting dogs, filled slightly. This is a beautiful spot, Lydia. I remember the first time I ever came out here. I was a teenaged boy, and Dr. Brown brought me along for the ride. Do you remember? It almost did me out of being a doctor for good. And suddenly she did. It was the day she and Sonny and Benny had gone along the creek on a picnic. Mrs. Foster had made them bacon sandwiches and peanut butter cookies and packed the food in a basket with a big ball jar of lemonade. The two boys had walked across the field, swinging the basket between them, and she had walked behind. They were all wearing Wellington boots over their bare feet, and Lydia had snuck out of the house in an old pair of Sonny's shorts. The three of them were wearing cast-off shirts with Ed Blessing's monogram on the cuffs, shirts that had gotten shabby or stained or torn at the elbow or neck. Sonny's hair shone in the light, and the back of Benny's neck was sunburned. They had set out lunch at a little grassy knob that sat above the creek, just around the turn from a big natural pool in which brown trout sometimes darted from beneath the dark banks to the glittering center. It was funny to her that things like this were so real and so detailed, when the things done as adults were reduced to a few gestures, a laying down of the fork here, a winning hand of bridge there. They had all three fallen asleep on the old quilt, Lydia dozing off with the sounds of mosquitoes, and Benny's hoarse breathing in her ear. And then she woke to find herself stiff and sweaty and alone. One of her wellies tumbled over the edge into the water. She climbed down to get it, and just around the corner in the pool, she could see the two boys from behind. Both of them were naked. They looked like the golden trout that had lasted in the pond only one summer because their tremulous glow had been such an easy target for predators. Lydia had stared at the shining pale flesh, her feet unsteady on the pebbles at the bottom of the stream, and then she scrambled back up the bank toward the quilt, dragging her thigh across a piece of slate so sharp that she felt nothing for a moment, saw only the puffy lips of her own ripped skin, the reds and pinks of muscle in that stop-time moment before blood rushed into the gap. "How in heaven's name did you do this, Miss Lydia?" Mrs. Foster asked when the boys brought her home, held aloft in a cat's cradle made of their thin arms. But she could scarcely remember the feeling of the stone slicing through her, could only remember that just before she scrambled up the bank, Sonny had turned his head in the late-day sun, coming lacy through the trees, and had smiled at her with his eyes half shut, smiled at her in a way that came to her in her dreams for years later, gloriously happy. It wasn't the size of that gash that scared the hell out of me, Paul Benjamin said. It was the way you sat on the edge of that kitchen table and didn't make a sound. Without being numbed up, too. Doctor poured a shot glass of gin in that wound, and that was all. I still have the scar, Lydia said. I'd imagine so. Lydia Blessing had never come close to remarrying. It was not so much that she covertly saw the physical side of things as the purview of the young, although she did, and found the imagined fumblings of her older friends ridiculous and demeaning. It was just that she could not imagine what it would be like to share her life. She could not imagine not being able to switch on the reading lamp next to her bed if she could not sleep at midnight, or having to ask someone else's opinion on dinner plans or weekend guests. She had had her ways from the time she was young, and she had never had to change them. The closest she had ever come to a love affair was with Bill Stapleton, who had lived just outside of Mount Mason on an old horse farm for as long as she had been at Blessings. He had been a childhood friend of Jesse's, and she had been seated next to him at an Easter dinner just after the war was over. He was quiet and thoughtful, letting her do all the talking, until she would reach one of her acerbic pitches and he would murmur, "You don't really mean that." But he had never seemed put off. He had brought Meredith a chutes and ladders game once, and a little hat with a feather when he took a trip to London. "That's a ridiculous gift for a little girl," she had said. But she had been secretly pleased, although she would have been more pleased if he had brought the hat for her. "Such sad news," Jess's daughter Jean said when she called just as the rain was tapering off, and then she told her that Bill was dead. That was the sort of deaths they had now. Such sad news. Once there had been the unthinkable deaths, like Benny's and Sonny's, deaths mercifully obliterated by sleep, so that each morning, as her mind surfaced from dreaming, she would have to accept them all over again. Then there were the deaths that changed the world, that broke it in two. Her mother, her father. There had been Jess's death, which had left her feeling as though she had stiffened her spine and her shoulders for the funeral and had never again let them go. The first had been the unthinkable deaths of youth. The second, the wrenching losses of middle age. Now there were the inevitable deaths of old age, which one after another prefigured her own. Such sad news. "I'll be there by dinner," Meredith said on the phone. "Eric can't get away, but I'll get in the car right after lunch." "There's no need," Lydia said. And yet it was a comfort now to have her daughter on one side of her in the pew and Jean on the other, as though Jesse were somehow with her too. "You drive people away, Lulu," Jess had told her after Bill married that nice woman from Philadelphia who had been at Vassar with one of Frank Askew's daughters. "What's the saying? No man is an island. You've made an island out of yourself. Benny wouldn't have wanted that." Thank goodness she had that photograph of Benny on the drop leaf table. Sometimes she could no longer see his face. Jess had always liked him. When they were younger, there were times when she had thought it was Jess he would marry, when she would watch the two of them making clover wreaths by the pond. She thought Sonny had thought so too, but Jess had made a face when she had asked once. "Benny's like a brother," Jess had said. And of course he had been like a brother to Lydia too, until he had become like a husband. Sonny had not wanted her to marry again. Perhaps that was what had decided her. "What's the point, Lids?" he said one evening on the porch when she was telling him about Bill and Bill's marriage. Or perhaps it was that trip to Paris when she had run into Frank Askew in the lobby of the hotel. His wife had invited her to lunch, almost dared her to come, and she had felt ashamed as she watched him eat, fast and loudly. Of course she had never eaten with him before. The most they had ever done was drink together, while a gaggle of complicit onlookers stood by. She'd been 40 on that Paris trip, and Frank over 60, and his dentures clicked like a piece of machinery. His wife called him old fellow and said he should slow down or he'd be up all night with heartburn. Later he had called her room, and she had agreed to meet him in the Tuileries, and then had not gone. It made her think that she had bad judgment where men were concerned. It made her think his wife had been wiser than she'd ever credited. The young minister eulogizing Bill was a kind of rebuke,
with his pale sideburns and ruddy face. He took as his text the poem Death Be Not Proud, and Lydia wondered if it was because he was more conversant with literature than with scripture. Bill's two sons, surrounded by their own children, were in the front pews, along with his widow, who had been a college friend of Bill's first wife. Paul Benjamin nodded to her in the nave. "All well at home?" he murmured, and Lydia nodded. Frank Askew's daughter was on the other side of the church, and outside on the pavement she came to Lydia and embraced her, which was just the sort of thing she hated. "I knew your father," she said to Meredith, and Lydia realized with a kind of lightheadedness that she no longer cared what Harriet Askew meant by that. "I have outlived my sins," she thought gleefully. "You can find a priest of a more appropriate age to bury me, Meredith," she said in the car on the way to the cemetery. It would probably have been difficult to find a priest Bill's age, Mother. He was 90, after all. 92 in September, Lydia said, adjusting her black felt hat. "And I assume there is at least one priest at St. Anselm's who is not young enough to be my great-grandchild and doesn't look as though he spends all his off-hours golfing." The cemetery rattled her more than she would have expected. There were all those names she knew on the monuments, all the men and women who had come to the house for cocktails and played mixed doubles at the club. On a knoll in one corner, she could see the edge of the square stone that marked the spot where Jess was buried, between her first husband and her second. And as the car came around a curve, there was the obelisk in front of her that her mother had insisted upon, with the one word at its base: blessing. The plot beneath was like her house, big and empty. Her father had purchased it the same year he bought Blessings, as though to show his faith in a future in Mount Mason that even transcended mortality. There were 8 spaces. Perhaps he had expected that he and his wife would have more children. Certainly he had believed that Lydia would have more than just the one. Surely he had not expected that his own 2 children would not want to join their parents in eternal rest. But one weekend when Sonny had come to stay, the 2 of them had walked around the pond, and he had flicked his cigarette into the water and said lazily, "Don't you dare put me in the ground after I'm gone, Lids. No box for this boy." They'd had quite a lot of wine at dinner, and she'd made a face and said, "Don't be morbid." But he would not be put off. "I mean it," he said. "I can't face the dark. Toast me to a cinder and set me free as a bird. Promise?" "Sonny, are you ill? Tell me if you're ill." "I'm just the same as always, dear heart," he'd said, and he'd kissed her on the forehead and waited almost 6 months to die on the dirt floor of the barn. "I'm thinking of your uncle, Meredith," she said as the car wended its way through the shady cemetery drives. "Are you? So was I. He told me after Granny's funeral that he would have preferred a kneeling angel with an armful of roses as the monument. I thought he was serious." "What a dreadful thing to say to a child. You were, what, 10, 11? "I was 16 when Granny died, almost 20 when he did. He always made me feel so grown up, and loved, too. There was no one like Uncle Sonny for making you feel loved. That was his gift," Lydia thought. "If he loved you, he made you feel all wrapped up in it, like ribbons or a blanket. If not, not." The minister had given a grudging little sermon about their brother Lazarus at Sonny's funeral, and she had never known why. Jess had said she thought Sonny had mocked him once about the cut of his cassock, and Lydia thought it might be the cremation that had done it. A whole carload of Sonny's friends had come from New York, several of them in light-colored suits, and gotten quite drunk at the house. "He was godfather to our daughter," one woman told her several times during the course of the afternoon. "We never considered anyone else, even my brother, no one else." She had found one of the men curled up in Sonny's single bed, weeping with a pillow held close to his face. All she could think was that her mother would have had a fit. "What would you say was your greatest mistake in life?" she asked Meredith in the car. "That's an odd question," her daughter replied. "Are you thinking of Bill? Of not marrying him?" "Goodness, no. That would have been disastrous. For him, probably." "No, I was simply curious." Meredith was silent.
Finally, she said, I never should have made friends with Betsy Millstone at school. She told all my secrets to the other girls, especially the really terrible ones, like stealing bits of jewelry and cheating in math. You stole jewelry? Mother, this happened almost 50 years ago. It's a little late for you to become exercised about it. She was right, of course. What a soft patina the passage of time gave to everything. At least once one learned to live in the present. That's not much of a mistake, Lydia said. I'm realizing that. I'm happy to say I haven't made too many terrible mistakes in my life. Quite the contrary. I've been lucky. Jess always said we make our own luck, Lydia said. I suppose there's some truth to that. Jess was always good at cutting to the heart of the matter. In any event, I guess I've lived a charmed life. I'm happy to hear you say that, Lydia said. A silence stretched between them. Lydia rubbed her left arm, which felt stiff and sore. Meredith came around to help her out of the car. Are you all right? She said, putting out her hands just as Paul Benjamin had done for the baby, and impatiently Lydia waved her away and used the door of the car to pull herself erect. Oh, for pity's sake, Meredith, she said, don't fuss at me. Remember, man, that you are dust, the young minister said at Bill's graveside. Thou, Lydia thought, thou art dust. Why did the modern drain all the ceremony from things? And unto dust thou shalt return. She had taken the boat and the box with Sonny's ashes to the center of the pond one morning just after sunrise. The surface was a mirror. The ashes were unexpectedly heavy, and they sluiced out like water, not like dust, and sank heavily except for a light penumbra that rose and held in the air. As she rode back, she had seen Meredith on the dock, wearing a straw hat, her hands crossed over her heart. In the air, the ashes looked just like glitter, Meredith had said, and her mother had loved her as completely then as she ever had. Lydia looked at her sidelong as they drove toward the club for the funeral lunch. Her skin was lined now by the sun, but her mouth was relaxed in that way so few women of her daughter's age could manage. Meredith had arrived earlier than she expected from Virginia the day before. She and Charles and Jennifer and Faith had been out on the long lawn by the pond, sitting in the shadow of the old flowering crabapple. Nadine had called in sick, and it was like being free of the dark schoolmistress, really, with cookies from the box and a thermos of sweet iced tea. The field opposite was thick with the last of the milkweed, and the pods had burst, and in the breeze the white feathers carrying the seeds floated thick over them like a summer snowstorm. The child's eyes seemed to follow them as she sat propped up against Jennifer's outstretched legs. I swear she's going to sit up by herself in a couple of weeks, Charles had said. It's real early for her to be doing that, but look how strong she is. I still can't get over how much you've learned about babies, Jennifer said, handing around the tea and paper cups, which Mrs. Blessing had always loathed. I read. Books, magazines, whatever. My mother had an enormous set of books about child-rearing that are in the house someplace, Mrs. Blessing said. Perhaps in the back room. I will see if I can find them. Our nanny thought they were nonsense. She believed there were only three things necessary to raise a healthy child. Fresh air, simple food, and quinine. I can't recall what the quinine was meant to do, but we were dosed with it regularly. My father says his uncle said your nanny was a terror, Jennifer said. Dreadful. But so were the foster boys. She would see them trying to hit down crabapples with a broom or eating tomatoes from the garden, and she would come out and give them a piece of her mind. There was a time when she took the broom from one of them and hit them with it on the bottom. But she was just doing my mother's bidding. She would sit up in her sleeping porch, and if she heard a disturbance, she would say, Nanny, please take care of that. My mother was difficult. Aren't they all? Said Jennifer. Did she use binoculars? Charles said, squinting up at her from the blanket. I can't recall, Mrs. Blessing said. Your mother called her Nanny instead of her real name? Times were different then, Mrs. Blessing said. She could not be certain exactly when times had changed. She knew only that when Meredith had arrived down the drive and walked over to them, Charles had stood up and said to her, "This is my daughter. Her name is Faith." And Meredith had looked at the baby in his arms, who looked back with her eyelids fluttering and made a loud declarative, "Ah!" sound. Meredith had smiled, and Faith had smiled back, then kicked wildly, using both her arms and her legs. A booty fell off, and Meredith bent to pick it up. Mrs. Blessing looked at her old watch. "You must have been speeding on the interstate," she said. "I was just under the limit." Meredith put the booty back on Faith's foot herself, then patted it when she was done. "What a pretty baby," she had said to Skip. "Aren't you lucky? How old is she?" "Your new caretaker's not married, is he?" Meredith said in the car on the way back to Blessing's when the funeral lunch was done. "Certainly not." "Well, I guess you can't have everything. He seems like a very good father." "It's an unusual situation," Lydia said stiffly, and Meredith grinned. "Mother, they're all unusual," she said, and was surprised when Lydia did not reply. He couldn't believe he was out of baby Tylenol, or Motrin, or whatever. The doctor had said Faith might have a bad reaction to the inoculations, and though it was a week later, he should have been ready for the fever and the restlessness. Maybe the problem wasn't the shots at all, but an ear infection, or a virus, or meningitis, or pertussis, or one of the other seemingly hundreds of things in the baby book that ended with the laconic sentence, "may cause death." He should have been ready, but there was always so much to do, to remember, to think about where Faith was concerned. He looked down at her flushed face and put his hand on her forehead. The feel of her hot skin reminded him of smooth stones baked by the summer sun. Hot on a warm night, the perspiration had gathered in the folds of her neck, and when he took her out to the car, it ran onto his shirt like tears. He kissed the fold between her small round shoulder and the puffy bend of her elbow and could taste it, salt in his mouth. Rubbing his cheek against her damp hot one, he said, "I love you, little girl." She bobbed on his chest and made a grunting noise. "We're going to bring this fever down," he said as he buckled her into her car seat, his words sounding loud against the cricket hum of the dark night. The lights in the house were out, except for the one in the downstairs hall that stayed on always. He drove slowly down the drive. There was an all-night drugstore in Bessemer. He'd had to wait in line behind a kid with bad skin buying Trojans and breath mints. Skip dumped four kinds of baby medicine on the counter for fever, for congestion, for coughs and colds, just in case. The older man behind the counter rang them all up. "It's always the dads that get sent out on an emergency in the middle of the night," the man said. "It's probably nothing to worry about." "Nothing to worry about," Skip said to himself in the car, "nothing to worry about." He was afraid to turn on the radio because he didn't want the sound to hurt Faith's ears, just in case it was her ears that were bothering her. Maybe the doctor would have to come back. Maybe he'd ask more questions this time about the grandmother and the traveling parents, a story that even Skip had thought sounded a little lame. As he drove back on the twisty roads over the mountain, Faith whined softly. It was October, and though the air was as warm and still as it had been all summer, the leaves were starting to fall from the black walnuts, and the water in the pond to chill almost imperceptibly. The trout had slowed down, and most mornings when he came back up the cellar stairs, he saw the bright yellow flash of the school bus through the trees along the road. Maybe someday it would stop at the end of the drive at Blessing's. Mrs. Blessing would be 81 years old just before Thanksgiving, and he figured, with luck, she could be living here 10 or even 15 years from now. She still moved really well, although she said the arthritis in the one arm was bothering her, and her mind was still certainly as sharp as anything. Faith snuffled in the back seat of the car. The doctor had not said a word about congestion. A fever in a few days, that's all. Mrs. Blessing's lawyer had come in a big, boxy black car. He carried a black briefcase as thick and square as a toolbox. "I am trying to get that child a birth certificate, Charles," Mrs. Blessing had said,
when she called him into the house after the man left. It gave him hope, the notion of lawyers, made the future seem more certain. For just a moment, he'd been able to see Faith, with a pink book bag on her narrow back, walking down the long driveway with him, hand in hand, straining to climb the steep steps of the bus, turning at the bleary window to hold up one hand as she settled in her seat. Mrs. Blessing would watch her from the sleeping porch with her binoculars. "Was that child properly dressed?" she would call down. "The thermometer says it's not much above freezing." "It's not as simple as I had hoped," Mrs. Blessing had said after the lawyer was gone. "But I have a man working on it." Nadine had come in then and cut off the conversation. "This crazy place," she said. "Too many people come and go." On the drive back from the drugstore, there were whirling things, in the air, on the road, so that the world seemed strange and vaguely dangerous, and he kept glancing over at the baby, who had fallen asleep, pitched to one side in that boneless posture that sleep brought when she was sitting up. Moths flew into, then off, the windshield, and a raccoon trundled across the road. Skip realized that he'd once been a nocturnal animal himself, sleeping with the flat of his hand over his face to keep the sun from waking him, closing McGuire's with the guys. But always there had been the sense that he was out of place, the same sense he'd had in his aunt and uncle's house and sleeping beside Shelley and in Debbie and Joe's trailer. He didn't have that sense anymore. He drove past the bar on his way down into the valley, saw that part of the neon had burned out so that it said MCGUES. Joe's truck was in the lot and Shelley's mother's car, and for a moment he had that feeling of a mug cold in his fist, the beer cold in his mouth, and the smoke in the bright eyes peering out of it saying, "Yo, man, you want to buy my brother's Camaro?" Or, "Yo, man, you want to buy some really good Hawaiian?" Or, "Yo, man, you want to crash at my place?" He remembered once when Chris's mother said that if you missed the soaps for a month or two, it was no big deal, because by the time you got back to them, people might be divorced or have amnesia or whatever, but in some way, it would all be the same, so you could get the drift in a day or two. And that was what it was like in McGuire's, except without the amnesia. When he got out of the county jail on a Wednesday morning, he'd walked in that night and Pat, who was tending bar, had said, "Beer, Skipper?" Exactly the way he'd said, "Beer, Skipper?" the night Skip got busted 10 months before. "I just got out," he'd said to Pat. "Yeah, it's cool," the bartender had replied, pulling the draft handle. It was a boring life, and Skip had confused it with an orderly one. It turned out that Skip liked an orderly life, too, just like Mrs. Blessing. She changed since he'd been working at Blessing's, but she still relied on rules so much that she sometimes talked to them, like fortune cookies for the well-behaved. No alcohol before 4 p.m. No mowing after 5. Early supper on Sunday, even if it was something Nadine had left with a yellow note in the freezer. Put in microwave 3 minutes. Gutters cleaned in spring and fall. If he was ever tempted to forget that there was still a dividing line between them, each morning he was reminded when he gave the baby her bottle, burped her, and wound her mobile to play Twinkle Twinkle Little Star while he went across and up the cellar stairs to make the coffee. "People of her generation are really into routine," Jennifer Foster had said to him. "That's why they basically like being in the hospital. The mealtimes are the same, the lights out. They like an orderly life." Skip was not sure that Mrs. Blessing liked it exactly, but that it was necessary to her. That somehow the smell of the coffee and the lunch on a tray and the light in the hallway were a hedge, the way the awnings were there so the upholstery would not fade. He wondered sometimes if she'd ever done anything wild in her life. And then he remembered what Jennifer had told him the doctor had said about the Cadillac in the pond. And maybe the conspiracy around the baby, too, was a piece of wildness. It had certainly made her livelier. Livelier, Jennifer said, than she'd ever been before. When he pulled into the driveway, he caught the glitter of eyes in the headlights. It was only the barn cat, with something small and limp and gray in his mouth. A bird cried out at the end of the pond, something like a child's cry, something like a cat itself,
and the animal raised its head, suddenly dropping its prey. The small thing lay frozen, then began to crawl toward the flower beds, disappearing into a patch of daisies and lavender at the foot of the stone foundation. But the cat sprang after it and emerged again with it in its jaws. A second cry came from across the water, but the cat wasn't fooled this time and ran off to finish killing and eating. As Skip turned the car toward his space in the garage, he saw a languid, angular ghost fly toward and then past him, banking over the water and then disappearing into the clouds. The heron, come to find fresh fish.
"You take out one of her old rifles and shoot those things. No one'll ever know," one of the tailors had said.
But he couldn't bring himself to do it. A light came on upstairs when he slammed the car door, and for just a moment he saw another ghost. The white face, white hair, white gown behind the wavy glass of the hallway window. He raised a hand, and the light went out. Faith was still sleeping heavily, and she sucked on the medicine dropper without opening her eyes, and only flexed her fingers as he put her down in her crib. She had the funny old bear that Mrs. Blessing had brought down from upstairs, and a stuffed elephant now that Jennifer had brought over one day, and a light summer quilt, white stitches on white cotton, slightly yellowed and smelling of camphor, that Mrs. Blessing had found somewhere in the attic. "There are some more things in the attic in the garage," she said. "Don't you go up there. I'll go up and find whatever is appropriate." The fan blew warm air over him, not so he didn't sweat, but so the sweat turned cool. The sound it made, lulled him into a light sleep. He woke once when the baby whimpered softly, but when he got up to feel her forehead, it felt cooler than it had before, and he fell quickly back into a deeper sleep. He was roused again for a moment when a big beetle flew into the fan blades and bumped around with a noise like a pebble in a bike chain. It was velvet blackout when he woke for the third time, deepest night, with one of the constellations hanging low over the pond, like a reflection of the string of lights that he had resurrected around it. The clock said it had been 4 hours since he'd given Faith the medicine, and he slipped the dropper into the side of her mouth with another dose, and she swallowed lazily, a string of pink drool making a dark stain on her crib sheet. On his way back to bed, he saw a long V-shaped ruffle in the pond, where something was swimming smoothly, a muskrat, maybe, or an otter, another one looking to pluck the trout out before Mrs. Blessing had even sent the check to the tailors. He thought of her looking out at him, and he turned to the window that looked toward the house and saw a faint light on the first floor and wondered what was keeping her awake. He thought he saw her pass in front of one of the kitchen windows.